We're up to the final parsha in the book of Bereshit, in the book of Genesis. Parshat Vayechi. Our parsha brings us to the anticlimax, it would seem. Yaakov Avinu is going to have a peaceful life, 17 years in Egypt, under Yosef's reign. And then he summons Yosef and says, I want you to promise me that when I die, you will take me up to bury me in Israel. Yaakov becomes ill, and Yosef is summoned, and Yaakov tells Yosef, you will have extra portions in the land of Israel. You should know, even though I've asked you to take me up to Israel, but when your mother died, I didn't. There was good reason why I buried her where she was. I didn't move her to Ma'arat HaMachpelah, where I'm asking you to take me to be buried. He asks to bless Yosef's children, and he can't see so well. So Yosef brings forward his two children. He puts Menashe, the older son, on Yaakov's right, and Ephraim, the younger son, on Yaakov's left. And when Yaakov goes to bless the kings, the kids above their heads, he crosses his hands. So his right hand, which represents greater blessing, will go on the younger son. And Yosef thinks that his father misunderstood him. He says, no, I didn't do it that way, Dad. I prepared them so that the older one will be on your right, not on my right. And Yaakov says, I know, but the younger one will still outdo the older one. That's why he needs the greater blessing. And he blesses the children, Amalacha Goeloti. And he tells Yosef, you will have that extra portion in the land of Israel, as we will see. And then Yaakov summons his children, and he gives them his final blessings. He speaks to Reuven about what he did wrong in his life, how he rushed and intervened in his father's marriage. He speaks to Shimon and Levi, and speaks to them about their fatal flaw, their anger that allowed them to be so destructive. He speaks to Yehuda, and he says, you will be the leader of the people of Israel. He speaks to Zevulun about his future as shipmen, and Yisachar, their future, settlers of the land of Israel and settlers of Torah. Dan and their future, how they will judge the people of Israel and protect them. They will live in the border cities. Gad, who will also be one of the people living on the border cities protecting Israel. Asher, who will have good territory. Naphtali, who will have territory that will flourish quickly. Yosef, who will now be a leader of the people of Israel in many ways, and Yosef's strengths. And then he blesses Binyamin. Finally, he finishes his blessings, and he passes away. And then he is mummified, whatever that means, and he is mourned in Egypt for a very long time, 70 days. And then he is taken up to be buried in Israel. And that is almost the end of the parsha. Just before the end, the brothers come back to Yosef and say, you know, your father asked that we tell you that you should please forgive us and you should make peace with us. And Yosef says, don't worry. Of course, things are going to be okay between us. And then when Yosef is ready to pass on, it's been 80 years since he ascended to the throne, he's already seen great-great-great-grandchildren. He tells the Jewish people, you will be redeemed from this place. Take me out with you. And that's the end of our parsha. Yosef's passing. He is buried in a casket in Egypt. And now let's begin our parsha again. I have a surprise for you. I'm going to tell you something you logically know, but you emotionally deny. And you have to realize it's true. And I'm sorry to tell you, but you're all going to die. I'm serious. Most people ignore this fact. And so people are caught by surprise when they do. And people are unprepared. And it's a terrible thing that people don't prepare for their own death. Very often people can leave behind tremendous fights because they did not prepare correctly for their own passing. And so the Torah repeatedly teaches us the importance of preparing for death. And you know, no one expects an accident. Accidents happen when we don't expect them. And that's why we have to be prepared for them. That's the idea of insurance. That's the idea of preparing, knowing that a person could die. Young couples very often don't buy life insurance. It's a critical mistake, excuse the pun. When you're young, it's cheap. Yet when you're young, it's important. You're married, once you have your wife is pregnant, get a life insurance policy. It's not expensive. You're young, then it's not expensive. If your wife's expecting, then you should know that specifically when people are young and they don't have financial stability and they don't have other sources of income, that's when it's really pivotal that they have that financial backing of having life insurance. When you're older and Bezrat Hashem, the kids are really, they're in their own path and you're part of a community and hopefully you've created some silent income and hopefully you have a pension plan and that's a different deal. When you're young, how much does life insurance cost you? It could be nothing. People can pay 20 shekel a month for a million shekels a life insurance policy. So what's 20 shekels? That's buying lunch once that month. It's very cheap. It's very, very cheap. Even at my age, I'm already an old man, right? And I'm not paying that much. Coming back to our parsha. So Yaakov prepares. And that's a big deal. Now, we're going to see the great leaders of the Jewish people prepare for their passing. And that influences the whole future of the family. The parsha tells us Yaakov lived in Mitzrayim for 17 years. The parsha is recording the piety of Yosef. If Yosef accepted from his parents for 17 years, they fed him, they took care of him, so he will give back for 17 years. Something to think about. In our generation, people think at the age of 30, their parents still owe them. And at the age of 35, they can't figure out why their parents want to retire. Who's going to help me out? Dad, you can't do that. Well, wait a second. It's the other way around. Part of the way we're supposed to think of life is we're supposed to be on the giving end, not on the receiving end. And even if we had a period till we reached a certain age where we had to be on the receiving end, we were supposed to outgrow it and be financially independent and hopefully be giving. So parents want to give their kids. And today, parents can work to the age of 70 and 80, etc. It's not the way life should be. They shouldn't be under pressure to work so that they can fund their kids who should really be standing on their own 2 feet. So that's what the parasha points out, that the last 17 years of Yaakov's life, Yosef pays him back. Yosef pays him back. He takes care of his dad. Now, just as a side note, people can sometimes destroy their lives because they heard a concept. You heard this concept in class, so a guy says, I can't continue in yeshiva, I have to go and be self-sufficient, and he can destroy his whole life. Because now he has to run out and get a job and make bupkis, peanuts, every hour. I'm not saying make a move today. I'm saying the general approach has to be that a person reaches financial independence. The general approach has to be that over time, I should be standing on my 2 feet, I should not be relying on my parents my whole life. So coming back to Parashat Vayechi, Yaakov lives in the land of Egypt for 17 years. He summons Yosef and he says, I want you to promise me that you're going to take me out of this place. Why does he need a promise? So what's going to happen is, when Yosef will actually come to bury him, so Pharaoh will tell him, you can't leave Egypt, I'm sorry, it doesn't work that way. And here we have two versions to the story. The simple version is that Paro is starting to close in on the Jewish people. The servitude of Egypt is beginning. When the Jews want to leave, suddenly they're not allowed to leave. Suddenly you need a visa, and the king says, no, you're not leaving. You want to leave? I need collateral. Leave me your wives, leave me your cattle, leave me your kids. Now you can go up and bury your grandpa. Wait a second. What happened? Until now we were guests here. Until now we were citizens. Since when do you need a visa to leave? Well, that's what happens. And that's what Chazal tell us. When you look in a Sefer Torah, our parsha does not have a break. Between the last week's parsha and this week's parsha, you don't see a break. It's hard to know where the parsha begins. And that's to indicate this idea that the Jews didn't have a break. Things started closing in on them. Just the idea that they weren't free to leave. Everyone's here focused right now. If I would tell you, gentlemen, no one leaves this class for the next 5 minutes, suddenly you get antsy. Wait a second, but you weren't planning on leaving the next 5 minutes. Right, but when you tell me I can't, it becomes unbearable. So, that's why Yaakov makes Yosef swear. He tells Yosef, promise me, I want you to swear. When Yosef will want to leave, Paro will say no. First interpretation, he says no, because he's starting to get them to understand that they can't leave. This is the beginning of the servitude. Second interpretation, Paro says, if you leave, well, you are the MVP here. It becomes a national threat to have you on the go. You can be attacked. How can I protect you? I have to send a whole army with you. And in Josephus, he writes that when Yosef left Egypt, he took a huge army with him, and wars broke out. The neighboring countries took advantage and attacked. And there were wars from the northern African countries that tried to attack Yosef en route. And we have recorded in Josephus tremendous wars, enemies that would remain enemies of Egypt for years to come because of the wars that transpired en route to Beri Yaakov. So again, the Medrash gives us the feeling Pharaoh is saying, you can't leave, I'm in charge. And the history books give us the feeling Pharaoh is concerned for the strategic threat of having Yosef en route, whichever one, maybe it's both. Yes. That's a different war. That's a later war. There were wars before he left, but there were wars en route. There were important wars en route. So when Paro is going to say no leaving, Yosef will say, but I have to, it's very important to my father. And Pharaoh will say, but I said no. And Yosef will say, well, you know, my father made me promise. I can't go back on a promise. And the reason that will get Pharaoh to give in is because Pharaoh has a promise that Yosef made to him that Yosef would never reveal, that he knows more than Pharaoh, that he knows more languages than Pharaoh does. He would not do anything that could usurp Pharaoh. So when Yosef says, I promised my father, what he's saying to Pharaoh is, you don't want me to start breaking promises, sir. You want me to keep my promises. And Pharaoh says, a promise is a very important thing. You definitely should not break your promise. Go bury your father. And Chazal say that's the code in the wording of Pharaoh. He says, go bury your father. Kasher ish b'echa, as he made you promise. Why does he add those words? To tell us it's only because of the promise that Pharaoh gave in. So that's why Yaakov makes Yosef promise. It's not that he doubted Yosef's integrity. It's not that Yosef's word wasn't enough. It's that the promise would make it that Pharaoh would have to respect it. Why does a promise have any value? When a person makes a promise, what he's saying is, by God's honor, I will do what I'm telling you. A promise is saying, when a person promises, he's saying, I'm swearing in God's name. In other words, in God's honor, that a person will keep his word. Okay, so Yosef gets word that his father is ill. But before that, at the conclusion of the previous conversation, so Chazal, the pasuk says, "Vayishtachu Yisrael al rosh hamita." Yaakov Avinu bowed towards the head of the bed. Vinny, can I trouble you to pass me 2 tissues, please? Thank you. It says that Yaakov bowed towards the head of his bed. We have over here a few halachic concepts. Number one, the Gemara and the Halacha says when a person is ill, when a person's seriously ill, so then Hashem yis'adenu al eres devai, the pasuk says. Hashem supports him. When a person's lying on his deathbed, so you should know that there's a special heavenly presence over there. He doesn't have to go to shul. If he's up to it, he could go to shul. But it says when we visit someone that's ill, so then we should keep ourselves lower than their head. because it's as though Hashem's presence is above their head. So when guys in the Machon would undergo their circumcision, and I'd come visit them, so then I'd sit down sometimes like under their bed, like at the foot of their bed, because the Shekhinah is hovering over their head. So you're not supposed to be higher than the Shekhinah. So it says Yaakov bowed towards the head of his bed. That's the idea. He bowed toward the Shekhinah. Our sages give us another interpretation. Our sages say he bowed to Yosef. Why does the father bow to his son? Because his son is the king today. And we have to know that sometimes when it's the fox who's king, then you have to respect the king. And this is food for thought for all those Facebook posts against Trump and Obama and whoever it is, Putin. If right now they have certain power, if they wield certain power, you have to think about whether you owe them a certain respect. Is it smart to be putting them down? I personally was uncomfortable when Netanyahu went to the Senate and spoke against Obama with the Iranian deal, because what was he accomplishing by it? Other than telling Obama just before his elections, I'm going to interfere in your politics and I'm going to tell the Congress that I'm against what you're doing. Now, I can't judge Netanyahu. I don't know his political, what he was thinking. Maybe he knew what he was doing and he gained from it. But the first approach we should have is what we learned from Yaakov here. Yaakov bowed to Yosef to teach us, in the wording of our sages, Ta'ala be'idne sagidle. Ta'ala, the fox, be'idne, when it's his turn to be king, sagidle, bow to him. But don't fight him. Right now he's the boss, respect it. Yes, sir. I didn't understand the question. You're talking about when he was a youngster? Well, they thought, why should he be king? He's a bum. They looked down at him. They didn't think he was worthy of it. They didn't realize he was worthy of it. I mean, he was a tzaddik, but they didn't see that. Yes?
When you talk about respecting the king's power, is it practical or is it more than that?
I don't know. I don't know if Chazal meant it only practically or because the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah tells us that even the one who's the foreman in charge of the lowest job, in their day it was the vegetable pickers. So the one who's the head vegetable picker, it says even that's decided in heaven. So I'm not sure if they meant it from that angle, from the spiritual angle, or from the practical angle. I don't know.
So you're supposed to respect our age to world leaders.
A certain amount, it's not smart. I respect him because right now he's the leader, whether you like it or not. You might be smarter than him. You might be more pious than him. You might be a lot of things. But at the end of the day, right now he's in power. So we have to respect that. There's a halacha that says you have to respect wealthy people. It's not just a practical thing. There's this idea that God entrusted them with a certain amount of power. Respect them. There's an old saying, why does the rabbi respect the wealthy and the wealthy don't respect the rabbi? So the saying goes, because the rabbi knows the value of the wealthy, but the wealthy doesn't know the value of the rabbi. There's truth to that. Saying it's out. Coming back to our parsha. So Yosef gets word that his father's ill. And he comes to visit his father. He has his kids there often. It's one of the things you can do for your parents if they're living close enough. So then it lengthens parents' life when they have grandchildren around. It adds a lot to them, that nachat. So it says Yosef would send his kids to be by Yaakov a lot. The simple reading is because it's good. They could learn from their grandfather. There's a lot to learn from him. On a deeper level, it's also good. It's good for grandparents to have their grandchildren around. So Yaakov feels like he has to explain something to Yosef. He says, I know all these years you've been wondering, when your mother died, how come I buried her so quickly, and I did not take her to be buried where I will be buried, in the great grave of the patriarchs, Ma'arat HaMachpelah. How come I left her by the side of the road and I buried her there? So he says to him, I know that ultimately that section will be your portion in the land of Israel. You, Benjamin, her descendants, and people prefer to be buried in their own family's plots. So I buried her in your plot, in Benjamin's plot. I buried her in the section of Israel, which will ultimately be her children. Ma'arat HaMachpelah, the cave of the patriarchs, will be in Judean territory. Why should she be in territory that isn't owned by her own children? So I buried her there. Our sages say another interpretation. Our sages say Yaakov revealed to Yosef that ultimately the Jewish people would be exiled and taken past Kever Rachel, as the verse in Jeremiah tells us, Kol berama nishma, a voice is heard in heaven, Ibechita murim, the bitter weeping, Rachel mevaka al banea, Rachel's weeping over her children, Me'analit nachem, she refuses to be comforted, she says to God, I'm not letting up. And even though all the patriarchs, Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and all the matriarchs, Sarah, Rivka, Leah, they couldn't move Hashem, when Rachel weeps, so her weeping breaks the heaven, and it was important that they pray by her burial plot. So from here, we see an important concept, that there is value to praying by a pious person's burial plot. There's value to it. You don't talk to the dead, but nonetheless, there's some value to it. Yes, sir. Rashi over there is explaining why, from Rachel's perspective, she wouldn't merit to be buried there. There are different perspectives. There's why it's important for the Jewish people and why... It's a long answer, Thursday night. If we have time at the end of class, we'll come back to it. But it goes back to the story of Rav Chaim Shmulevitz and the orphan. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz and the orphan, the kid who said, I don't deserve to be an orphan. But remind me, Thursday night, we'll come back to it. Thursday night, join us. We did it already a few weeks ago, so come back Thursday night, we'll come back to it. If we have time at the end of class, I don't mind going back to it. Yaakov explains to Yosef why his mother was buried there. It's interesting to see how Yaakov saved some things for the end. He doesn't always... he knew this was bothering Yosef. That doesn't mean he has to address it. Now it's come the time where he has to address it. Part of the wisdom that parents have is knowing that you don't have to answer every question. You don't have to deal with everything today. Some things have to wait. Some things a child won't understand till they're much older. So, it's also as an educator. When I started teaching, so our principal, our high school principal, Rabbi David Katzenstein, said to me, he said, remember a rule. As a teacher, you have to think long term, and you have to be prepared for the fact that children evolve and it takes them time to develop. Parents pressure you and they want their child to change today. They want to see the products today. And you have to withstand their pressure and teach them that things take time. Children don't change overnight. They grow over time. Coming back to our parsha, Yaakov blesses Yosef's children. Hamalach ha-goeloti, the angel that saves me, Yevarech Tanarim, will bless the children. So here we have a Pandora's box. Do we ask angels to bless? Are we allowed to talk to angels? I thought we don't work with emissaries. How does that work, this idea of asking an angel to bless? So this is where we start having a gray area on halacha. That although we ordinarily say, any time you want to talk to God, you can talk to Him. You don't need intermediaries. That doesn't mean that angels don't exist, and that doesn't mean that angels can't help. Meaning it's different than saying, I can't talk to God without an angel. We say anyone can talk to God. You don't need an intermediary. But that doesn't mean just like I could daven for someone, and you could daven for someone, so that an angel could also daven for someone. it's those are two different concepts. On the one hand, I don't need it. On the other hand, that doesn't mean I can't use it. Doesn't mean it doesn't hurt, that it doesn't help. Those are two different things, right? The halacha says if you have someone sick in your home, go to your local Orthodox rabbi and ask him to pray for your sick. Wait a second, what do I need him for? I'll pray. Right, you pray, and he'll pray. Doesn't mean him and not you, it means also him. Ask him to pray. Hopefully his prayer is going to do something too. Yes? Okay. It's a good question for when we learn Shabbos, yeah. Or Thursday night, yeah. It's a good question. Coming back to our parsha. So, most of our leaders and our kings came from Ephraim. Yoshua bin Nun and most of the kings of the northern 10 tribes, and that's why Yaakov insists that Ephraim gets blessed with the right hand. Yaakov tells Yosef, I'm going to die. He tells Yosef, I'm giving you a portion more than your siblings, a portion I fought for. And from here we see that Yaakov had to fight battles, even though the Torah doesn't record them. From here you see there were battles after Shimon and Levi conquered the city of Shechem. The neighboring cities, they had some type of treaty, some type of pact. It could be NATO, it could be whatever it was. They came together and they fought. And the simple reading of the text tells you that Yaakov Avinu fought to retain those territories, Shechem, and that's why he gives it to Yosef. Now what's really happening here is Yaakov is setting up the scene on two levels. We're going to first learn Yaakov's blessing on a simple level, which most people never learn and don't know. After that, we will learn the Medrash, which is what most people learn, Rashi's interpretation, which is probably more important than the first pshat. But being that most people never learn the first pshat of what's going on in the blessings, we'll do that. Even though I concede that the second pshat we will learn is more important. That's what everyone knows, what Rashi says, the Medrash. So in pshat, Yaakov is telling Yosef, as it says in Chronicles, in Divrei Yamim, Reuven lost it. Reuven interfered in my marriage. He destroyed my marriage with one of my wives. When he started interfering, he took my bed out of Bilhah's tent and put it in Leah's tent. Now I had an issue with Bilhah. And ever since then, Bilhah and I are separate. He interfered where he had no right interfering. And so he lost his rights to the kingship, to the firstborn, to the leadership. And Yosef, you will get the double portion in the land of Israel. That aspect of being the firstborn, I give to you. So Yosef gets a huge territory. When you look at the map of Israel, Ephraim, Menashe, they constitute 33% of the land of Israel. He really got a huge portion. That's what Yaakov tells him, yes.
You say that all the portions are equal in their value?
Maybe. Maybe. Yeah? That means there's one place in the Gemara and Tractate Sanhedrin that sounds like what he said, and there's a big discussion between Nachmanides and Rashi and their commentary on Torah whether we take that literally the way he said it. Yes. Coming back, that's what maybe means. Maybe means it's a big topic we have to go into, and now's not the time. coming back to our parsha. So Yaakov summons all his children. And he says to Reuven, I admit you're the first son. Bechori ata, you're the first son. Kochi v'reshit oni, you are my strength, you are my first strength. You should have had much more than everyone else. Yeter se'et v'yeter oz, you have more strength than you should receive, more strength than everyone else. But pachas kamaim, you were quick like water that flows in a stream, al totar, to lose all your benefits. You were quick to destroy your future. And al totar, he warns Reuven, don't fight it. You are not the leader. You will not be the king. You will not get the double portion. You lost it. And he warns him, do not fight the tribes now. because you've lost it. Why? Because you interfered. As chilalta, you desecrated Yitzui Allah. He doesn't want to say you desecrated, so he says whoever it was that interfered with my beds, he lost it. He doesn't want to say it directly to Reuven. He doesn't want to destroy him. Our sages say when Yaakov gave Reuven over the head, Yaakov Avinu waited till his last days, till he had no choice but to put the facts before Reuven. People have a horrible habit of saying, let me tell you what I think of you. Let me tell you what you really did. Let me tell you what you're really worth. I have a friend who told me, I don't know if it's true, he told me he has a sign over his desk that says, if I bought you for what I think you're worth and sold you for what you think you're worth, I'd be a millionaire. That's a terrible sign. That's a terrible thing. You want to develop people. You want people to feel good and grow. You have to give them a great feeling. Chazal say Yaakov waited till the last minutes where he didn't have a choice till his last days, because he said, if I try to rebuke Reuven earlier, he might leave me and join forces with Esav. Reuven, you're talking about a huge tzaddik, Reuven. So he made a mistake. But you're not talking about someone like us. And yet, Yaakov Avinu says, if I would have rebuked him earlier, he might have forgotten everything. And this is a very important rule. We grow based on the feeling we receive that people value us. And as parents and as educators, if you want someone to grow, you have to give them the feeling you value them. We once caught on. We would come home every day, pick up the kids from school, and come home and see the front yard covered with wrappers from igloos, from ices. And we always, my wife and I would say to the kids, you know, we can't figure out which neighbor has kids that are so unruly that they eat so many ices, so many sweets, and they throw them out on the floor and they dirty the yard for everyone. But you guys be tzaddikim, collect the wrappers. And this is going on day after day, and the kids are collecting the wrappers. One day, my wife and I, the kids are sleeping, and we start preparing. One of the kids had a birthday party, and we go to get all the sweets that were prepared for the birthday party, and they're all gone. And we discovered that while we were sleeping, the kids were getting up every night and raiding from the freezer to the pantry to every sweet under the sun. And they knew to hide the evidence. They'd go out to the porch, close the door, sit there, have a sweet party, throw all the junk out on the yard, come back in, and by the time we woke up in the morning, like nothing happened. And then they'd come home from school, they'd have a straight face. They wouldn't tell us anything happened. And when we'd say, we know you didn't do it, but let's keep the yard, that's everyone's yard, clean. Let's clean it up. It'll take us 2 minutes. They did it and they didn't say a word. So we were shocked. My wife and I looked at one another. Wow, they all this time they've been doing this. And it went on for weeks. So we never thought to look, right? They took every sweet out of the freezer and everything. So we sat there thinking, and we came to a few conclusions. We said, number one, we messed up. We trusted them with sweets that were more than they could handle. We gave them a test that was beyond what you could expect kids to handle. Number two, we are not going to tell them that we're onto them. Because if we come and say, kids, you're a bunch of thieves, that's it. You ruin their self-image, so then they have nothing to live up to. The most important thing you could do for a child, if you want them to grow, is to make them think that you think positively of them. So we grabbed all the sweets, and we put them somewhere else, we locked them up somewhere, and we never spoke about why that happened. For months! It's like, we didn't talk about it. We said, we have to learn a lesson. We as parents, we did something wrong. They also did something wrong. But you want to work on that, work on it in a roundabout way. Don't go head on. You tell a kid head on, I know you stole, I know you took what you weren't allowed to take, you should feel terrible. What'd you do? Are they going to have the strength to build themselves? If you keep talking positive. And then on Shabbos, you tell a story about a child that took something he wasn't allowed to take, and he felt very bad about it, and he knew he would never do it again. And you tell different stories slowly, you help them build themselves. You want to build someone, they have to feel like you think they're positive. If you tell your child he's the scum of the earth, then he will feel like he's the scum of the earth. And he will ultimately live up to that. He will have a very hard time proving you wrong. He will, on the contrary, feel to a certain degree like he's living out your prophecy of who he is. And so Yaakov does not rebuke Reuven. Reuven has done something pretty severe, and he's paying a huge price for it. But Yaakov never goes head on and says, Reuven, you know you're wrong. You know what you just did? You know how much you're going to pay for what you just did? He doesn't do that. And you see, Reuven does do tshuva. Reuven works to become a better person, and he's working day and night to do tshuva. But he has the support of his father. On the contrary, the pasuk says right afterwards, Yaakov says, I have 12 kids. What would we do? We'd say, I have 11 kids. Reuven, get out. Reuven, what are you doing? Destroyed a marriage. Leave. You're an old child. Go. Deal. Build your family. No. The declaration right after what Reuven did was, Yaakov has 12 kids. He's part of the group. We don't have time. We're moving forward. So now that Yaakov's on his deathbed, he tells Reuven, that trait that you moved so fast, that you moved so fast in the name of justice and did something so wrong, is a fatal flaw. You cannot lead the Jewish people. You will not be the leader in any of these points. And don't fight it. Don't make an inner battle. One of the rules, one of the important things people have to do before they pass on is ensure that there won't be fights after they go. So he tells Reuven exactly what his role is going to be. He turns to Shimon and Levi and he says, you two cannot be the next leaders. I know I said Reuven's not going to be the leader, neither are you. Because you are achim. You are united in your anger. You two are prone to anger. And klei chamas mecherotehim, you guys matched up and decided that together you can go and destroy. And bisodam, he says, leaders are people who have secrets. I will not let you be people who have secrets. You will not be leaders. Bisodam al tavon afshi. I will never approve of you two being leaders. Bikalam al techad kvodi. I am unwilling for you two to be the ones who unite, gather the Jewish people. Why? Ki ba'pam, when you guys got angry, halguish, you killed people. You will say you killed the people of Shechem because they made your sister into a woman of ill repute. And I will say, says Yaakov Avinu, that your anger got the better of you. A person whose anger gets the better of him cannot be a leader. You guys were ready to kill. You killed out of anger. You cannot be the leaders of the Jewish people. And even when you're not angry, you would be capable of taking any person that you thought deserved it and just cutting the legs of their oxen and causing them to be incapacitated. And so Yaakov Avinu says, with those traits, you cannot be the leaders. On the contrary, Arur apam ki az, I curse your anger, says Yaakov Avinu. It is too powerful. It is not good for you. Let it be diminished. Achalekem, I will scatter you among Israel. The Levites took that curse and implemented it as a blessing. They became the teachers of Israel. And so they were scattered throughout Israel to teach Torah. And the tribe of Shimon had their portion right by Yehuda so that the king can keep an eye on them, so that they'd behave. That's why the tribe of Shimon was right there. Yehuda, he says, everyone will admit you should be the king. I said, why Reuven not? I said, why Shimon and Levi not? Yehuda, yes. Why? Your hand grabs the neck of your enemies. They're always running from you. Everyone respects you. All the family respects you. Gur Aryeh Yehuda, you are like a lion. Miteref Bini, you are like a lion that devours its prey. And no one stands up to you. You take down anyone who tries. You're like a lion that you don't let go until you decide to let go. And it's not only from when you become king, but lo yasu shevet mi Yehuda. From now on, you will be respected as the leader, even before kings are established in Israel. But it's only when Shiloh happens, and that when Shiloh was destroyed, that's when shortly thereafter, 2 years later, David became king. He says, only then will your kingship begin, after Shiloh will be destroyed. But until then, you will also be respected as a leader, as we find. The tribe of Yehuda led the way in the camps. The tribe of Yehuda led the way in the sacrifices. The tribe of Yehuda led the way in the judges of Israel in the book of Judges. The tribe of Yehuda led the way when it came to the wars after Yeshua passed away from the world. So the tribe of Yehuda was the renowned leader already from Moshe's time. You, Yehuda, you are Osri Lagefen. You tie your iro, your donkey, to grape trees, and your mule, your aton, you tie to branches of grapevines. It's not like you go to war because you don't have enough food in your own territory. You go to war because you're protecting your people. You go to war to develop the economy to help the poor. When there isn't enough food in the country for the poor, you go to war to ensure that the poor are fed in your country. That's what David HaMelech did. He says, you're very good looking. Chachlili einayim miyayin. You look red like wine. You're well fed. Ulven shinayim mechalav. That's the pasuk we described earlier, right? White of the teeth from milk, right? He says to him, you'll be well fed. Your kids will be with red skin because they're well fed. And they will have beautiful eyes and beautiful teeth because they will have good milk. Zevulun, you will develop by the sea. All the way to the north. Yisachar, you will settle the land. You won't be interested in making tons of money by going to faraway countries. You will settle and see that it's much better to be home with your family and develop in Torah, even though it's hard work. When you travel, you come back, you make a huge profit on all the goods you bring. But Yisachar, you will prefer to be home, and you'll see it's much better to have that tranquility of being with the family at home. Dan, you will lead Israel. You will have a descendant, Samson Shimshon, who will be unique among Israel. Our sages say Shimshon was one of the greatest sages that ever lived. I know we don't think of him that way. Chazal say that only Shimshon could judge like God. No one else is described that way. When he would judge a case, it was like God was judging the case. Now Dan had the territory on the northernmost tip of Israel, which means they were the pivotal, from a strategic perspective, they were the pivotal tribe. When we were attacked, we fell through the north. Mitzachon tipatach ha'ra'ah. The Navi tells us, you should know, when the nations will attack, the Babylonian Empire, the Assyrian Empire, even in the Second Temple period, they will come swooping through the north. So that northern tribe is a pivotal tribe in protecting Israel, and that's why Yaakov blesses them. They should be like a snake that lies on the path. Anyone that tries to come down the path to Israel, they will bite them. And today, I don't know. Who's our biggest threat today? Hezbollah in the north, no?
Yeah.
Okay, so you tell me if it's relevant today.
Am I supposed to see correlation there? That's what I'm saying.
I have no idea. Don't know. And Yaakov Avinu ends their blessing with a prayer, Hashem, I hope for your salvation, because Dan has to succeed. All of Israel counts on Dan's success in the north. Gad is on the eastern front, right? Reuven, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh, they're protecting Israel on the eastern front. So he says, Gad, they should be successful in getting their battalions to succeed at war. Asher will supply Israel with a lot of good food. Naphtali will have the territory that flourishes most quickly. Naphtali is the northern part of Israel, meaning Tel Aviv area. Yosef. What is Yosef? So he says, Ben Porat Yosef. Yosef is fruitful. Ben Porat is like a fruitful tree. Aleayin, on a stream. A tree that grows by a stream is very fruitful. It has limitless water, right? Banot, his daughters, a tree's daughters are its branches. Sa'ada aleishu, his branches go dancing on top of the walls. Imagine you have a stream. You have a tree growing by the stream. And right next to that tree you have a wall. A wall that's trying to fortify a city. And the tree grows and its branches just penetrate and climb the wall. And instead of the wall protecting the city, the wall becomes the support for the tree's branches growing along the wall. So that's how Yaakov Avinu describes Yosef. Yosef is Alei Ayin. He has the stream. And he grows on the wall. What's he saying? Everyone tried to keep you out, right? They said, you're not going to be king. And then they sold you to Egypt. That very wall that was supposed to keep you away from the throne. Why? Because they're going to stop you from being king. They sent you to Egypt. You just climbed the wall like that tree and you penetrated. You became king. They said, let's go see what comes of his dreams. Yeah, you showed them what came of the dreams. Potiphar's wife thought she would overcome you. She would imprison you. She would force you to do what she wanted. Well, through that prison, you interpreted dreams and again came to the throne. Anytime they tried to stop you, you took the barrier, you climbed it, and made it the stepping stone to your next success. That, says Yaakov Avinu, is Tzada Alei Shur. You climb the walls they try to make to stop you from growing. That's your strength, Yosef. And that today, in today's terminology, if you read the book by the guy who invented Intel, what's his name? He calls it the inflection point. I forgot the name of the book. Inflection point, what? The guy who invented the chip, Intel. So he writes that every business reaches a point where it's sink or swim, where suddenly everything goes wrong and the business is about to implode and be destroyed. And it's at that point that you have to figure out how to take all the calamities you have and make them the source of your success. That's the strength of Yosef in ancient terminology, right? So Yaakov Avinu called it, your branches climb the walls. The walls don't stop you, they become your stepping stone to success. In modern terminology, what do they call that? If they dish you lemons, make lemonade, right? If you've gotten if you've been given a batch of lemons, then make a lemonade stand, right? Take what your challenges are and make them your strength. Your brothers and your Potiphar's wife, they made you like a target for their arrows, varobu, and you outgrew them. And over here, we learn that the brothers spoke bad about Yosef, just like he spoke bad about them. That he was their target. We always hear one side of the story. Yosef spoke bad about the brothers. Here, Yaakov reveals, vayemareru, they tried to embitter you. They spoke badly about you. Yosef was outnumbered. He had 10 brothers talking bad about him. Varobu, but you overcame everyone. Vakeshev beitan kashto, your bow was more powerful than theirs. You overcame everyone to the point where you rule the world. You are the king of the most powerful empire. Vayafozu zoyadav, your arms became the most powerful. He's comparing him to a bow that shoots from far. That's Yosef's strength. So he's saying your arms became most powerful. Your strength comes from me, Yaakov tells him. You have that strength. You're the continuation of the strength of my family. And you should have the blessings from above and the blessings from below. And your families should prosper. Your children and your daughters should prosper. He ends with the blessings for Binyamin, that Binyamin is like a wolf, that the wolf kills and moves on. He doesn't wait to eat his prey. He destroys his enemy and moves on. And that's the idea of King Saul's dynasty, that Saul destroyed many enemies, but he didn't stay to devour his prey. He did not have a dynasty that went on after him. David is like the lion. The lion kills and then enjoys his prey. Yaakov concludes his blessings and asks to be buried in Israel. Our tradition is that he told his kids who gets to stand on which side of the bed, and this would be the shape of the people of Israel throughout the desert. The way the tribes were aligned in the desert was the way he told them, and this reflects the strength of each tribe, because each tribe has a color that represents their strength, and every tribe would wear their talis with that color that represented their strength. Every tribe has a stone that corresponds to their strength, and every tribe has certain personality traits, and that's why their blessings reflected their personality traits. And every tribe has stars that reflect their personality, and that's why every tribe has a month that reflects its personality. So we spoke about a color, a stone, a personality trait, the stars, right? The tribes are represented in many ways, a month in the year, right? And that's why he also tells them how to be arranged around his bed, and they're taking him up to be buried in Israel. When they come to Israel, so Esav shows up. By the way, the interpretation I just gave of the blessings, which was the first interpretation, is not well known. Most people know the Midrashim. I did not do the Midrashim. What I did is a pshat in the blessings of Yaakov. The Midrashim, you guys have Rashi in front of you. You'll learn it. You'll understand it. I don't see that we'll get to it tonight. It's important, but I prefer to give what I think you won't encounter in most places. So coming back to the end of the parasha, I'm just saying I had said I would continue to a second pshat. I don't see us accomplishing it tonight. If you want, on Thursday night, we can do it, Bezat Hashem. So when they come to the land of Israel, Esav shows up with his men. And Esav says, what are you guys doing? Yosef has a challenge. He's there with all the Egyptians. Many kings of the countries that saw them going have sent their representatives along out of respect for Yosef. He is the most admired king on the planet. Remember, he saved the world. He was the one who had food for everyone. So now when they're heading to Israel to bury Yaakov, they all come along, and as a show of respect, every country they would pass, the king would send his crown and put it on Yaakov's coffin. And so Yaakov's bed is being taken up to Israel, and he has crowns being laid around his body. And when they finally reach the land of Israel, so everyone's watching, and his twin brother shows up, Esav shows up with his army, and he says, what are you guys doing? So they say, we're burying Yaakov. And Esav says, there's one spot left in that cave, and it's mine. So Yosef, the brothers, they all say, no, you sold your rights. When you sold your rights to the firstborn, in that contract, it also said that you're selling your rights to your portion in the cave of the patriarchs. Esav says, no, it doesn't. They say, yeah, it does. He says, show me. Everyone's watching. They have a huge crowd there, kings from all the nations. There's action. So the brothers have to show them. They don't have the deed there. They tell Naphtali, you're the quickest on your feet. Run back to Egypt. Get the deed. So Naphtali starts running back to Egypt. Everyone's standing there. This is the scene. Yaakov has a grandson. His son Dan had a child named Hushim. Hushim was deaf. So Hushim is watching all of this go on, and he doesn't understand exactly what's going on. So he turns to them and he makes a sign. He says, what's going on? Grandpa's body is lying here. Why aren't we putting him in the grave? So they make a sign to him. That big man, yeah, he has a sword. He says no. And we have to show him the deed. So Naphtali went running back to Egypt to bring the deed. And then we show him, he'll see it, and he'll let us bury. Hushim says, that big man, he's not letting us bury Grandpa? Oh. So Hushim grabs a shovel, and he walks up behind Esav, and he gives Esav such a whack on the head that he knocks his head off. He literally slices Esav's head off. And war breaks out. So the Medrash, everyone knows, is that Yosef's head, Esav's head fell off. According to one version of the Medrash, it landed on Yaakov's stomach. And Yaakov opened his eyes and smiled. According to another version of the Medrash, his head rolled into the Maaseh Machpelah and was buried there. His head got buried in the Maaseh Machpelah. But according to Josephus, and other sources, other Midrashim, war broke out. And this is one of the wars that Paro was worried about. Because Esav and the families of Hori and Seir, they weren't about to take this sitting down. They had just killed their grandfather, their great-grandfather. If Yaakov had developed into tribes, so had Esav developed into tribes. And according to the Midrash, they lost the war bitterly. But they would attack Egypt again and again until finally the Egyptians would start hating the Jews. And they would say, why do we have these enemies from northern Africa attacking us? It's all because of the Jews. So this did not pass on so peacefully. But again, it doesn't record any of this in the Parsha. And the Parsha just says he was buried in Maaseh Machpelah. When Yosef is about to pass, he tells the Jewish people a code. He tells them every exile will have a letter that represents that exile. We know that in Hebrew, we have Minatz Pach. We have the letters that are doubled, that they show up one way in the middle of the word and another way at the end of the word. We call them Minatz Pach, the letter Mem. In the middle of the word, the Mem has one shape. At the end of the word, it's a closed box. The letter Nun has a bend in its leg. In the middle of the word, at the end of the word, it's one straight line. The letter Tzadi, same thing. It becomes a straight line. Minatz Pach, the letter Pei, and the letter Chaf, right? Those are the letters, five letters that Mem Nun Tzadi Pei Chaf. Those are five letters that change when they're in the middle or the end of a word. So Minatz Pach, our tradition is that each of those letters represents a different exile. And so Yosef, when he's about to pass on, he calls in the family and he says, here's the tradition I have from my father. Pakod yifkod Elokim etchem izeh. Hashem will still redeem you from this land of Egypt. But you should know that the true Redeemer will come back and tell you words that are with the pay. The situation of Pharaoh, the situation here in Egypt, revolves around the letter pay. Every exile has its letter. This exile is the letter pay. The letter Pei, yes, Pei. and the true Redeemer will come and he will say this code. He will use a double terminology using the letter Pei. That's why when Nun will come in the beginning of next week's Parsha and tell the Jewish people it's time to leave Egypt, so the tribe of Ephraim will go with him, because he is a descendant of Yosef, he is arrogant, he is a leader, but he doesn't have the code. He won't come in with that double terminology of Pei. He will just show up and say, time to go. I counted the 400 years are up from the covenant, the Brit Ben Abtarim. Time to go. And he will lead tens of thousands of people out of Egypt. And they will all be killed, as is recorded in Chronicles in Divrei Yamim. And only then does Moshe come to the scene and the Jewish people say, wait a second, the last guy who showed up 30 years ago got a lot of us killed. Why should we listen to you? Well, that's the code that Yosef leaves them with. Hashem will still redeem you from here and take my bones out of here. And with that we end the book of Bereshis with Yosef's passing after he has sustained the world. The book of Bereshis ends with the hunger for bread, which is resolved by the kindness, the epitome of kindness. Yosef HaTzadik, who's willing to turn a blind eye over everything that was wrong to him. And the book of Bereshis ends with Yosef's kindness to his siblings, Yosef's passing, which will lead us as a united people to face the book of Shmos, the Jewish people in servitude in Mitzrayim.